You're very welcome to the latest episode of the Greg Hughes podcast. Today I'm going to be joined by Bridget Biddy McLaughlin to discuss her book, Tales of a Patchwork Life, specifically focusing on the chapters that document the devastating murder of her sister, Siobhan McLaughlin. In 2006, Siobhan was murdered in her home by her husband, Brian Kearney. What followed was not just a quest for a conviction, but a grueling multi-decade battle for the McLaughlin family. From the fight for custody of Siobhan's son to the frustration of witnessing Kearney's cushy life behind bars, Biddy pulls no punches in describing the reality of the Irish penal system. We'll be discussing the investigation and trial, the evidence that eventually brought Kearney to justice, the parole cycle, the immense psychological toll that frequent parole hearings take on Biddy's elderly parents, legislative reform, Biddy's advocacy for life to mean life and the urgent need for the parole system to be reformed in Ireland, and resilience, how a family survives the unthinkable and finds the strength to campaign for change. This is a conversation about the gaps in our legal system and the enduring power of a sister's love. Okay, Biddy, thank you so much for joining us this evening. If I could start by asking, how long have you been thinking of writing this book, and why? Why was this important for you to do?
The memoir was on my mind a lot because when you go through situations like my family have gone, which are very abnormal for most people, you have to kind of quarantine yourself into some kind of peaceful mode and collect yourself after years of post-traumatic stress disorder, which we've all suffered from and still do. So the book was a very clear kind of structured way of putting to paper how I felt, my experiences for what they were worth, and also remembering Siobhan as the person that she was. And she was quite exceptional, as you can read in the book. And also, of course, to describe what he was like, which was appalling. Like, I refer to Brian Kearney in the book as the Savage, and it's probably the best name I can think of for him. I don't even like using his name. But the book was extremely important to me for that reason.
Yeah, when obviously when this person came into your life, what was the first impressions, if you're comfortable talking about that?
It's quite extraordinary, right? Because I can rarely say this about anybody. I'm a very social person, and my family are as well. When my family met him, we all met him. There was about four of us met him together that day. My mum, who's an absolute lady and extremely friendly, could not shake his hand. And I felt, just didn't feel, my immediate impression was, this is so not Siobhan. This is so not the kind of person I imagined for her. He was very nondescript. He was a small man, stocky stature. He just had no personality. There was no kind of gentleness about him. There was no curiosity. There was no manners. He just didn't hold it. He didn't shake hands. I noticed that he didn't pay much. He wasn't very attentive to Siobhan, which is very, you know, something you notice.
Yeah.
There was no emotion about him. So I didn't like him at all. On sight, I didn't like him. And unfortunately, she was my closest sister. But unfortunately, being her closest sister as one of them, I had to tell her how I felt because she asked me. And I said, this man is not for you, Siobhan. I said, you're vibrant, you're vivacious, you've worked so hard. I said, what do you see in him? What do you see in him? As sisters would say, this kind of chat.
Yeah, of course.
And she said, Biddy, he's not a womanizer. He doesn't drink hardly. He doesn't smoke. And he's safe. Now, looking back, that was like appalling. When you think about that wording. And when I'm doing these kind of interviews, I always think of the women who are listening to this program, Highland Radio, or any radio program. And I always like to make the point that if someone is listening to the radio now and they're about to separate, which many people are, or they're under kind of fierce kind of stress in a house where someone is, you know, literally threatening them or saying, like, you know, separation and divorce are the most critical times for people. And I remember going to my solicitor with Siobhan and asking his advice about Siobhan when she was leaving him. And the solicitor said, is there any history of violence? There was none. And he said, stay in the family home. And Siobhan wanted to stay in the family home for the sake of the children, Wrong.
But unfortunately, many sort of women, and to some extent men, but we know it's primarily women, sort of make that decision themselves and wait too long, and it's all for all the wrong reasons. It's never for themselves, is it? It's for the family, it's for the kids, it's for whatever.
It's always for the sake of the child.
But to have a professional, to have a professional sort of enforce that, very concerning.
Yes. Very concerning. And if anybody's listening there now, please, I know they say, well, where am I going to go? I've nowhere to go. There's always someone to go. Even if it is a women's refuge centre, you're better off safer there than you are in a house with an absolute savage like he was. And there are plenty. Now, men are fantastic, as we know, and there are male victims as well. But for people that are violent and people that are vicious to women, you have to leave them. They're not going to change. They're just not. And it doesn't mean they have to be an alcoholic or anything. This guy was totally sober. He was totally sober when he throttled Siobhan, where he manually tried to strangle her, and she was still alive. She was still alive in her bed, and he'd locked the door of her bedroom. There was no escape. And she was still alive after his first strangulation. And then he put her with the hoof of a Dyson Hoover around her neck and hung her over the bathroom door. Now, the reason I'm saying that without flinching is because I want people to know what some people are capable of. Now, if you had told me, Greg, that my sister would have had a death like that, 2006, there's no way I would have believed that we'd have anybody like that in our family, that any of my members of my family would have a death like that, that was premeditated. And her two-year-old son was in the room next door. And he went down the following morning and he gave him a bowl of Cocoa Pops and left him on his own. You're talking about, this is like a manipulative, callous, evil man. And there are very few manipulative, callous, evil men around, but there are enough of them that need to be curtailed. We all know the amount of domestic coercion and attacks there are in Ireland. Donegal has its fair share like every other county, and domestic violence, regardless of everything, whatever happens, these prison sentences are just not enough. Yeah. Brian Carney is now in Wheatfield 18 years. We have a parole coming up now, right? My 85-year-old mother, who's very unwell, my 92-year-old father, who's from Carndonagh, 92 years of age. Can you imagine? And he has to write out every 3 years a letter to the parole board to say why Brian Carney, who he is appalled by, obviously, and hates, why Brian Carney should be let out, a man who has never admitted his crimes, ever. Most people that apply for parole admitted their crimes and question whether it's good rehabilitation or not. I'm not going to go there. But this man has never admitted what he did. That horrific thing he did, he's never admitted it. Why should he even be allowed parole? It shouldn't be happening.
Well, how could you even put forward an argument for parole if you are in prison for a crime you won't admit to? I mean, the parole, exactly, surely in that instance shouldn't, because theoretically you're seeking to be released having been potentially, rehabilitized for something you claim you never did. So it's an oxymoron,
exactly,
isn't it?
Yeah. It's an oxymoron. It makes absolutely no sense. Appalling. The other thing is that when he gets all our letters, which he will get, he will look at, and we always change the letter slightly every year, right? Depending, because this never changes. Like, this is ongoing post-traumatic stress, ongoing trauma, and it triggers my parents, particularly all of us, but particularly my elderly parents. Can you imagine? He's going to read my dad's frail writing. He's going to read the writing. He's going to read my dad's thoughts on him. He's going to read my mom's thoughts and all our thoughts. We don't see his thoughts. We don't see anything from him. So he's there in his little library, his cozy library, looking at all these, no effect on him because he's no emotion. And he's no problem with that. And the parole board has no problem with that. And I have major problems with that. I learned a new word the other day, and I like learning new words. It's called liminality. And it means transitioning betwixt and between. That's where we are. We actually can't transition. We can't move forward because we are stuck every time we relax. And my mother is terrified of him coming out. She's elderly, coming out to get her, and I have given him so many. I mean, I have, I've never stopped the fight to keep him in there. None of us have, but I, particularly my journalism and everything, and to highlight the issue. And I've never stopped, and I never will, because I absolutely despise him, obviously. The idea that men and men like him can do this and get away with it, which basically he has got away with it. He's actually sitting in prison. We are the ones who are serving the sentence. We're the ones who are going to her grave 3 times a week. We're the ones who are her dealing with son. We're the ones that who we love. We're the ones who are dealing with the, you know, the horrific, horrific memories, flashbacks that come back, and it never leaves us. As some actor said recently, you know, how do you deal with the loss? And we say, well, he said 50% of your day is happy and the 50% of your day is sad. And I'm a very jovial person, I can tell you, Greg, very, and all my family are. And, you know, so it's very, you know, we're very positive people, but we have to change the law that these animals, and they are animals, I have to say, these absolutely horrific men, the few that there are, but they're getting more, by the way. We're getting more of them. As you can read in the news, every day there seems to be a new murder and they seem to get no sentences. And we are going to keep at this.
Yeah, and if I could just go even a bit, earlier in often what is the, you know, the story, and I use the word story, but it's not to in any way diminish what we're talking about. We still have issues with when there are clear signs of domestic abuse and escalating behaviour, that it's not really treated in a way to prevent the inevitable deaths that come to pass. In other words, it's not just at the end, if I could put it so bluntly. It's when the clear signs are there, the behaviour, being able to know if someone has a conviction for domestic abuse, for an example.
Yes. Well, for anybody listening, the key signs are well known by a lot of people, but not by everybody, obviously, right? The key signs are, the first thing they do is isolate you from your family, isolate you from your friends. They have a problem with your family and they have a problem with your friends. These are the first two key signs. Then they have a financial strictures on you, right? Then the belittling happens, the diminishing you, saying you've got fat, you've put on weight. Then if you ever do this, I'll take the children away, right? The threats. And it's emotional gaslighting. And that's how it starts, very slowly, very slowly, not even noticeable at the beginning. But soon enough, if your family notices it, your friends notice it, you're not coming out, why aren't you coming out? Oh, I have to go back. You see your friend coming, changing from a fantastically lively person into someone who's scared, who is kind of fragile, who hasn't any strength. So all the changes, these changes are subtle, but they get more alarming and more obvious as time comes on. But they are the key signs. Control. Everything's controlled by them.
Yeah, to reduce you to something only they could love, as they might put it. And also, it can also escalate to threat of suicide. If you were to leave me, I will kill myself. It will be on you. It'll be your responsibility.
Exactly.
Just in relation to...
Yeah,
I was going to say, obviously, this individual, classic coercive control signs were there. But just in this whole process of him not admitting the crime he was found guilty of and knowing that he's putting, you know, you and your elderly parents through what he is, does it ever keep you up at night that in some way he's still doing what he was doing to your sister, if you know what I mean, that he might be deriving some sort of a pleasure from this?
Oh, no, absolutely. Greg, he's deriving total pleasure from this. Total pleasure from this, yeah. He gets a kick out of this. He gets a high out of this because he's a sadist. He's an emotional sadist. He's a physical sadist. If someone did to an animal what they did to Javon, the people in marches on the streets, like all over the world, he definitely gets a kick out of this. He is the most emotionless man I've ever met. He's like a machine. In my book, I call him like a box from IKEA. There's nothing, only a box sitting in front of you. I remember and none of us ever socialized with him because we couldn't bear it. There's just a nondescript nothingness about him.
Do you then believe that by the time he was introduced to you, that he had got his emotional claws into your sister? Because, you know, she even how she described what he brought to the relationship, you know, for many people, that's not enough. And he convinced her that that's what she needs. Do you allow yourself to even consider that, or is too much time passed and two severe instances happened between now and then?
I think he was controlling from the very beginning. Yes. Because she was a self-made woman. She worked since she was 16 on building sites. Then she set up her own company. Then she became a chef in the Shelbourne. Then she had a very successful business. Then she opened Salvia, obviously, the hotel, which is still there. And so she was her own. She wasn't like, depending on anybody. The saddest thing for me is that I had this amazing, independent, wonderful sister who was taken in by him, like many women are. They're taken in. And this thing always, he's safe. Nobody's safe. Nobody's safe. We don't know who someone is. Someone now listening and they're like going through a crap time with somebody and they're there and they're saying, I'm afraid of him or no, he won't do it, but he might do it and he's never done it before. If you have any doubts, walk out. If you've any doubts, you walk out because you could be saving your life. You think it never happens to you, and it can, and it could, and it possibly will. You have to go, and you've got to bring your children with you.
And it was obviously calculated to, as you mentioned, giving the impression that your sister had taken her own life, leaving his son there, presumably, to create the impression that, well, what dad would do that or whatever.
Yes.
That's also what people need to look out for too. It's the level of planning and just how low someone might go. How soon was it for you? How soon was it for you that you realized that this was a crime committed by him?
Before I left my sister in the car, asking to go over to her house in Inachinshea in Dundrum, in the car I knew immediately that he had killed her. And Aisling knew immediately that he killed her. We knew immediately, Greg. We didn't know how he'd killed her, but we knew that he had done it. And the horrific, the absolute like deviousness to put a girl. She had loads of plans. Thank God, people, you always look into people's relationships. The guards have to forensically scrutinize every relationship. Siobhan never had an affair. She was really an honourable. She believed it. She had her prayers. She was just a sweetheart. And he deviously planned this, and he actually tried to. I actually believe that he tried to kill her before that. She went on a last trip to, and I mentioned this in the book, Tales of a Patchwork Life. The last Christmas I spent with her in Austria, and her mother-in-law gave him skiing lessons, and her mother, his mother-in-law, or my brother's mother-in-law, gave Brian Kearney skiing lessons, and Siobhan was delighted to get a break from him, and things were very tense then. And Flavia came back that evening. I said, how'd you find him? And she's been dealing with like tourists for years, 40 years. She said, it was really strange. He was the strangest person I ever had skiing, she said, because he was totally and utterly in a different world. He looked like he was concentrating on something completely different. And we really believe, because he managed, like he's, making her, leave here and do this and take flights here, and she didn't want to. So he's coercively organizing her life for her. And she didn't want to, and she's suspicious of it. Then he left the house one night. She left the house. When she came back, there was gas outside the house. Herself and mum, the smell of gas was just, intense. And there's a gas leak. So it wasn't the first time that he tried something.
Yeah, and as is articulated in the book as well, which I think is a must read actually for, not just people I think for people who may be in a similar situation or people close to someone in a similar situation, because the patterns are so often there. But you also had to. It was not just the awful loss of your beautiful sister. It was even before the trial began. It was custody of her son, the family
Yes.
property.
Everything. And can you imagine her 2-year-old son, Dan, was with him for 2 years before he was arrested. He wasn't arrested to 2000. He wasn't arrested 2008. He wasn't convicted to 2008. So her son was with him in his house, with his home. I would see Brian Kearney around the place because I live outside. I would see him at one stage in the book. I mentioned, sitting at the traffic lights and he's smiling across me. Like even in the court case, he was smiling at us, smiling at my brother, smiling at my father. I mean, he's a sick, sick psychopath, sociopathic. Sick man, and he got joy out of this, and it was very hard for us, pretending Siobhan had committed suicide with all our plans ahead of us. We knew that, and the minute I got to the house, then I tried to talk to the detectives, and because I was a journalist, they didn't really, they didn't want. It was unfortunate for them that I was a journalist, basically, because they didn't. Obviously, they said, "Oh, we give Micah Hames this now. We're going to have to deal with her." And I just said, "I need to talk to you." They said, "We can't talk to you." I said, "Listen," I said, "I'm telling you now. This is not a suicide. This is a homicide. a homicide, right? And then eventually they sorted it out and realized what it was. But it's very easy, and it's another thing about suicides. God bless anybody who has to deal with it or go through it. The other thing about suicide is it's so easy for someone to say someone took their own life and they didn't. It's such a thin line. It's a thin veil between someone doing it and someone not doing it and someone setting it up as if they did. It's very easy to do. They just say, oh, she had a bit of depression. Oh, she was in, like, you know, she took antidepressants, she took anti-anxiety, and oh, she wasn't feeling great. It's their word against everybody else's.
Can I ask, if it wasn't for your advocacy and perhaps even maybe the fear of getting this wrong, could he have got away with it?
Could he? Yes, he could have got away with it. Yes, he could have got away with it. If we didn't voice those opinions, I mean, it looked like a suicide until they discovered Siobhan's diaries, where she was getting her hair done the next day, where she was planning to go off on a holiday with her friends, where she was meeting the family, because Siobhan was a totally, even in her last days, she was an upbeat person. She was certainly stressed, no doubt about it, but she was upbeat and looking forward to the future. And people can get away with it, and people have got away with it. That's even more alarming if you think about it.
He's denied it. What do you believe his motive was? Because we can't.
His motive was very simple. It was money, Greg. Mm. Money and control, jealousy. Nobody's got. You know the famous look. Nobody wants. You can't have it. No one will. But it was also money. She was a very successful money. She had as much money as he had.
Yeah.
And he had no interest in Dan. That was the interesting thing. Anytime Dan came up with most people who are separating, the first thing they do is talk about their child. They say, listen, let's forget about us. Let's talk about Dan. He was no interest in Dan. He was quite jealous of Dan. That was always obvious. He had no interest in, and he never held him. You know, he never did anything with him. He just had no interest in him as a child. And he was a gorgeous child and he's a gorgeous person. But I mean, can you imagine not being interested in your 2-year-old son?
Unbelievable. It's impossible to think. With all of
blue eyed guy who loves everybody, you know?
Yeah, of course. And with all of that and with his demeanor, you know, obviously his ability to control or manipulate. How concerned were you that the jury could fall for it, you know, that he could get away with it?
I missed that last sentence. Sorry, Greg.
How concerned were you, given his form, that he could have got away with it, that the jury could have fallen for his demeanour or his...
No,
his...
I don't think... He has no personality, so they wouldn't have fallen for that, right? But, you know, he had no hope at all because the forensics could describe everything in detail and how it was impossible for her to have done it. And it was horrific during... criminal case, seeing the door of her bathroom, which I passed by and talked to her so many times, leaning against that door, looking at me in the court, right, and my parents. And you have a forensic man, a fantastic man from UCD, putting weights on ropes and pushing it over the door. So the whole thing was just so difficult and horrific to watch and deal with. But he wouldn't have got away with it then. But at the beginning, if they hadn't, you know, it's very easy to say someone committed suicide, but they didn't.
Mm.
As I said, it's, you know, it's a very vague grey area. And you have to be, you really have to advocate for your loved one to make sure that it wasn't a homicide. That's how bad things are. I mean, it's awful that we have to be doing, my family have to be doing all this work. We shouldn't be even dealing with a parole, as I said earlier on.
Of course, and I don't want to talk about that, but just in relation to the suicide and the stigma associated with that, people like him can use that as a shield almost, if you know what I mean, because so many suicides are don't go reported. Thankfully, the coroners seem to be doing something about that now, but you just hope that people like him can't use that stigma that still exists and shouldn't, or that underreporting as some sort of a cover story, so to speak.
And imagine he's using the awful thing of suicide, which affects so many poor families in Ireland, right? He's using that to keep himself, you know what I mean? It's in the money that he wants. That's what he's using, just using that. I mean, it's just, thank God Siobhan kept diaries is all I can say. Thank God.
You talked about, thank God indeed. And in fact, she was the best witness, even though she wasn't there.
Yes, she was the best witness, even though she wasn't there. It's all pretty shocking, isn't it, Greg? It's all pretty horrific, you know?
It's horrible. And it's from the pages of a book, quite, you know, like a fiction book or a TV show, and it's your lived life and experience. It's shocking. And again, you know, what's written is written, but this is ongoing, isn't it? And there's another parole hearing coming up.
Yeah, it never ends. It never ends. Yeah, and my family, we were a very close family. Some of us still are, but like, there's a huge rupture in the family because everybody grieves differently. Everybody grieves differently, and some people want to talk about Siobhan. Some people can't bear to talk about Siobhan, including myself at times. Even though I do this on the radio, I have to keep her in the news. And you can't forget a life force, which she was. I mean, this idea that time heals, it doesn't heal. It doesn't heal at all. There's no healing. All there is you move on, but you don't move away. And you have to, it's very important to say that there's no healing. You can't heal from something that's so horrific. You never will. In fact, the older you get, the worse it gets. So, yes, indeed.
Is there
Yes,
another
indeed.
parole hearing in March, am I correct in saying?
Yeah, there is. And the parole hearing's coming up now, probably be April.
Yeah.
But we're on, which they're sending us emails for the last 3 weeks, and they'll be sending us more emails, to organise for separate family members to meet the parole board because there's so many of us. And the other thing is this, that it's we have three generations now of cousins, nieces, nephews who are listening to this all their
Yeah.
lives, you know what I mean? And they're eavesdropping on us and they're hearing about these things. So it's a generational nightmare. Nightmare.
What needs to change in terms of the law, in your opinion? Firstly, I mean, I don't think jail should be, I think most people listening don't believe jail should be as cushy as it is. And it
Oh
seems
no,
he has a very cushy existence, although
no,
his
no, no.
freedom is curtailed.
Yeah, no. Someone, I mean, he's in, as now going back a while, right? The sickest thing for us was, or the most upsetting and distressing thing was at the very, there's so many, but at the beginning, he's only in prison a year and he got an award for first aid. And I just said to myself, oh my God, he got an award for first aid, right? Now he's learned Spanish, he's studied law, so he's planning to go back to Spain, I'd say. Now I also know that he's ill at the moment. And we know that from the parole board, and because they have to tell us for what hospital he's in so we can avoid it, and so he's ill, so he's probably going to use his health as like compassionate leave, you know what I mean, from a prison.
Yeah.
So I'm going to if I I'm going to fight this tooth and nail that he doesn't get out.
The
I'm just
problem,
going to fight it tooth and nail. Our whole family are, and.
it's just the system seems to be facilitating and prolonging the coercive control, the abuse, the trauma.
Yeah, and
That's not
yes.
an effective system, is it?
No. And he's still controlling. He's still controlling what we do. Like he's still sometimes I say to myself, like my dad gets, he's obviously he's a very strong man, and I mean, and he's a very fierce, strong man, and he's a great man, and we love him dearly. But sometimes, when I see him crying or something, he talks to Siobhan in his apartment. You know what I mean? He
Yeah.
is like, he has a little, and little bits and pieces that she, cards, Christmas cards he sent her, from the El Chefo. You know what I mean? Love you, Daddy. You know what I mean? Like, so he has these cards that he looks at, hangs them framed. You know what I mean? Little receipts of something she gave him, framed. You know what I mean? Like, it's just so poignant, Greg. And I'm looking at him there, looking on. He talks to her when I when sometimes I stay with him, I can hear him talking to her. You know what I mean? Up in the front room, and then he stops when I come in, and all those little ordinary things,
He's
they're
been
so
blessed.
upsetting.
It's so saddening because he's been blessed with longevity, but I'm sure part of him feels it's actually, a life sentence and not the
Oh
gift
no, it's a
that.
life sentence. It's a life sentence, Greg. He's there, like he is an insomniac. He doesn't sleep. All he has is he found Siobhan. He kicked the door down to her bedroom, and my mum as well was with him. So I mean, how in the name of God could you deal with that? You
Yeah,
couldn't.
it's the
You couldn't
trauma
recover from
and
that, and
everything that went
we
for.
never will. The great thing is we've got,
Would it
yeah.
matter if he admitted his crime now? What would that mean to
No, it
anyone?
would. It wouldn't matter because we wouldn't. I mean, in the sense that, like, you could understand a parole if he had admitted the crime. You could understand why they want a parole. But because he has never done that, it makes no sense. Now, if he admitted it to us, it makes no difference. He could have admitted it years ago. You know what I mean? But anyway, we know what he did, and that's never going to leave us. And the only good thing I have is that I look very like Siobhan. And there's a little bit of kind of, there's a little bit of delight in me that every time he sees my face in the paper for dealing with this or anything else, that I hope he's haunted by her because I'm the image of her. And that gives me a certain amount of joy, believe it or not. that he has to look at me and he has to hear me, and he's no control of that. And when sometimes the tabloids as well, you know, obviously they read this, they, you know, they publish the stories, and I'm delighted with the tabloids. I'm delighted with anybody that gives us a voice. And being a journalist, I've been privileged to have a voice. A lot of people who have families that have gone through this haven't had the voice that we've had. And I regard that as a privilege and a bit of luck as well.
The book Tales of Patchwork Life, a memoir of the stories that keep me. Everything we've talked about, obviously, is horrendous, okay? But yes, also, there is a story here of resilience. There's a story, too, of, you know, finding your space, a space presumably half of that day where you can exist and be happy and live your life. And you know, so as well as, I suppose, chronicling this story, which will be of interest to, for people to read, and hopefully might be the final push someone needs to get out of such a relationship, there's also a tale there of how we as humans can cope with the most impossible.
Yes, and survive. And I have to say, I am resilient, Greg, and I have survived. My family have survived. The word is survive. But I also live a very happy life. I mean, like, I mean, as best I can. I mean, obviously, as I said, 50% of the day, you might not feel like that. And there are days when I just curl up in the fetal position and a settle bed and stay there for 4 hours. You know what I mean? And then I just get up again. But I live a kind of very busy, happy life. I live a very simple life. And I honour her existence by doing that. And I remain calm, and I never think of him really until the parole, because I don't want him to have power over me. I mean, by thinking of him, I'm having power. He's power over me. So I won't give him that power. I refuse to do that. And so I have certain ways of dealing with what I can, I can. And I also, being the eldest of the family, you know, you really have to, you have a kind of responsibility to your child. The eldest is always the one, like a meerkat, keeping vigilant about everything, watching everything, being alert to everybody, minding everybody. And I've always been like that. And I feel enormous duty, because Siobhan, myself, and many of us, we all did that for each other. And Siobhan was the first to be there on call, you know what I mean? Attentive, to help the family, to look after mum and dad, to look, you know, to be helpful and kind. And I had to honour that as well, joyfully, I may add. But also, Brian Carney, we're never going to change what he's done, but we can change the women who are listening to us. And I know that there are women listening, and I'm going to say it again. I know there are young women or older women listening to us today, and they are in a horrific situation, probably crying in their kitchen, terrified for their kids, terrified from themselves. And all I can tell them is leave, leave, leave. Just go. Instinct is a powerful thing. And if, you know, they say, like, sometimes what happens then is, as we know, sadly, these guys go and kill the children as well. So get out, go, go, go as fast as you can, and to give them no notice of it, silently leave the house. And nobody wants to go to a refuge centre, but most people do have people they can go to. The families already know the situation. But instinct, go. If you want to be alive. The amount of domestic violence and the amount of homicide is at its highest rate ever in Ireland. Highest. So be alert, think of your children's future, and bring them with you, and get out as fast as you can.
Okay. Listen, as I say, this is a nightmare that continues with another parole hearing coming up potentially in April, and having to go through that all again. Finally, what's your message to the powers that be in terms of what a life sentence is, in terms of when someone is eligible for parole, you know, with the victim in mind rather than the perp?
Yes. Well, first of all, it's in America, right? Sometimes you find, I was looking at a homicide there in America, where the murderer got 40 years, and the family were out protesting 40 years, right? They're protesting because nothing can replace a life, obviously, and certainly time can't. So from what I say to the parole board is, he cannot get out. He should never have any options for parole, and he should never leave where he is. Never. He should never be let out. He has never suffered. Siobhan had the most horrific death, as you know. It couldn't get any worse. And he did it. He did it with his own bare hands. And he did it, and he planned it to the last T he taught. And he did that. And no person, no man or woman who has done that kind of crime should ever be let out. They should be behind bars. And also, they should be suffering behind prison. They should be suffering. They should not be given all the great, you know, the great things they have. They should not be giving the best food, gluten-free this, gluten-free that. Some of them are allowed to have one beer a week, I'm told. They shouldn't be allowed anything. They shouldn't be allowed anything. Now, I also have to add that there are a lot of people in prison who have great sympathy for. Prisoners who have started off on the wrong track in life and they've ended up in the wrong thing. But these are not murderers. These are just, you know, prisoners who have gone on the wrong track. He is evil, pure evil.
Yeah.
And if they let out pure evil, our lives will change again.
Of course. And we need to be in a place too where it doesn't take such strong advocacy just to get a prosecution and ongoing perpetual advocacy to keep him locked up, because I think without you guys, without you, of course, Biddy, would he have ever been charged? And without this constant cycle of parole applications, you know, without what you are doing as a family, he'd probably be out roaming the streets, and leopards generally don't change their spots.
Yeah, like I'm going into Dickens night tonight with friends of mine in Clontarf, and you know, today I was thinking of, obviously, I was with my father and we're talking about it, and it just takes over every conversation. It takes over a section of every conversation every day, you know, and it's very normal. You have a normal life. But that said, I am strong, I am resilient, and I am, I just, you know, I have to protect myself. But the system is appalling. It's appalling. And people are always saying, you've got to be very careful with the parole board. You can't say this, you can't say that. It's time we started talking straight with the parole board. They have to wise up, and they have to start stopping all of this. We can't go on like this.
Bridget Biddy McLaughlin, thank you so very much for all of your time and chatting to us on the podcast. Tales of a Patchwork Life, a memoir of the stories that keep me. People will be very keen to get their hands on a copy. Available online, I know, and also from Mercia Press, and also, I presume, in all bookshops.
My pleasure, Greg.
Thank you very much indeed. Thanks once again to Biddy McLaughlin. Now, of course, if you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this podcast, please do not stay silent. You can contact Donegal Domestic Violence Services on 1800 262 677. Women's Aid can be contacted on 1800 341 900. Men's Aid on 01554 3811. Or, of course, the Gardaí. And that's it for this episode of the Greg Hughes Podcast. Don't forget, we have new episodes for you every Friday. They're live on our website, highlandradio.com, from 11 a.m. And if you have any comments, questions or suggestions, feel free to get in touch with us. You can contact our researcher and producer, Caroline Orr, at carolineorr@highlandradio.com. Until next time, we'll chat to you.